You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Welcome to the Work in the Ruins, all of yourselves. Welcome to Work in the Ruins, everyone watching at home. And welcome to the stage, Paul Northrup.
A very warm welcome. It's really my privilege to introduce this next session to you. I'm not going to be in conversation. I'm just going to set it up and then I'm going to clear off and I'll come back to help with the Q&A. I'll just say a few words. At a festival whose theme is hope in the making, it's vital that we are honest about the things that we actually have to work with. And a thinker and a writer who gently insists on such realism is Dougald Hine. And we're so delighted that he is able to join us this morning all the way from Stockholm. His book, At Work in the Ruins, is, I would suggest, a line in the sand for people of good faith and activists yearning for a deeper way of living. So it's my pleasure to introduce, and I would like you to join me in giving a warm Greenbelt welcome to Dougald Hine.
Good morning, everyone. Good to be joining you from afar. We've almost got used to the strangeness of being gathered and scattered at the same time, talking to each other through screens and cameras like this. I mean, how many friendships and relationships, how many family gatherings, how many work meetings, even meetings for worship have happened through these technologies in the last 5 years or so. You've all been there. And I was thinking that nonetheless, there's something a little strange about being with you when you are at a festival in this way. In the early years of the Dark Mountain Project, Paul Kingsnorth and I used to run an annual festival called Uncivilization, which wasn't quite on the scale of Greenbelt, but I have the memory of that sense of coming together and going off, you know, being together in a space that's somewhere off to the side of ordinary reality, somewhere a few steps back and to the side from the everyday, in ways that can be very generative, in ways that can give you a lot of nourishment that you then have to take back and see which parts of it make sense when you get back to the everyday. So as familiar as I am with this experience of talking to people over long distance, nonetheless, I'm aware of a particular strangeness to it on this occasion, because there you are, many of you, in a field at a festival partway through a weekend. And here I am on a Saturday morning in a borrowed room in a co-working space in Stockholm at the end of what has been the first week back to school for my family here in Sweden. So there's a little bit of the sort of jet lag of the whole household re-establishing the term time temporality rather than the long days and long evenings of summer and getting up earlier in the morning. And I'm also in another space that, in a more inward way, has some of the strangeness of being gathered together with a bunch of people at a festival, because I'm in the early stage of working on the groundwork of a new book, which, you know, which takes me, as my family will tell you, takes me away from the surface level of the everyday, sometimes in ways that might make me not so easy to deal with. But one of the things that I find myself doing in the beginnings of the work on this book is looking back to the workings of my last book, At Work in the Ruins. And one day this week, I brought up the document that I sent my publisher with the first full draft of that book. And it reminded me that when I sent it to the publisher, at work in the ruins. It went through various titles. At that stage in the process, I thought it should be called The Kind of Hope Worth Having. And my publisher vetoed that quite sternly, said, you cannot have the word hope in the title. Now, it struck me at the time, this was a North American publisher, and that perhaps the word hope had been burned out by the Obama years. It had been emptied out. It was no longer had much currency. Certainly, there is a cheap way that the language of hope gets used. I'm thinking of Bonhoeffer's words about grace and the German church offering people cheap grace. And what is the costly grace? What is the costly hope? And when I read the invitation to this theme of hope in the making, it struck me that that's part of the question that you're carrying at Greenbelt this year. The Kind of Hope Worth Having didn't become the title, but it is a phrase that appears a few times in At Work in the Ruins. And the way that I describe it is I say the kind of hope worth having is the kind that lies on the far side of despair. That sooner or later, in our own journeys, collectively or on our own, we come to the place where it's necessary to have what we thought hope was stripped away from us. It's necessary to release our hold on hopes that no longer ring true and take the risk of having empty hands and see whether anything else is going to show up into those empty hands. There was a story that I heard when I'd almost come to the end of writing that book. In fact, it's a story that came my way thanks to Liz Slade, who you're going to be hearing in conversation with Brian Eno just after this session, I believe. And Liz forwarded me a mail from one of her Unitarian colleagues in Cambridge, which had a link to a talk by the philosopher Federico Campagna, who is the author, among other things, of a fascinating book called Prophetic Culture. And I hadn't been tracking Federico's work for a long time at the point where that came my way. But some of you will know this. Sometimes you're in the kind of the last stretch of a long creative project, and just as you're approaching the end of it, you encounter the work of somebody who seems to have arrived at a rather similar place by quite a different route. And that was the sense that I had when Federico's work came across the horizon for me at that point. And the story which I heard him telling, and these are not necessarily quite the words that he uses, but it goes like this. Sometimes you're born into the ending of a world. This is a thing that happens. It's happened to others before you, in other times and places. What's the sign that you were born into the ending of a world? It might be that the future no longer works. When people try and stand up and speak to the future as a source of hope and an animating force for collective projects, it doesn't ring true in the way it did a generation or two or three earlier. Because the future in the ordinary sense is a line which we extend from the recent past through the present onward in a continued trajectory of promise. And when you're at the ending of a world, the story of that world doesn't have much left to run. There isn't a future that offers continuity of hope. You might notice that those who are able to make most of the running politically are speaking to the past rather than the future. Anthony Barnett pointed this out back in 2016. He said, you know, the most important words in those two slogans, make America great again and take back control, were again and back. The potency of appealing to the past tells us something about the moment in the timeline that we're at. So Federico Campagna, he says, well, what are your options? What moves are left to you if it is your discernment that you were born into the ending of the story and the world that you were born into? And he has two suggestions. He says, first, to the extent that it's possible, stop worrying about making sense according to the logic of a world that is ending. Be willing to appear foolish. And secondly, look for ways to make good ruins. And after At Work in the Ruins came out, I found myself chewing on those words in every talk and every interview that I did. It just kept coming up. I kept bringing them to different rooms and seeing what was released as we went on chewing on them together. And at a certain point in that process, I began to wonder, well, what are ruins anyway? And one answer is they're materials, resources broken loose from an existing structure, a structure which has served its purpose, to be put to use in ways that the makers of that structure would never have imagined. My friend Ed Gillespie sent me an extraordinary set of photographs of a church on the Suffolk coast, not far from where he lives. It was built in the 15th century during a period of great prosperity in this coastal small town. They built this very high, beautiful church building. And a couple of centuries later, after the end of the Civil War, they appealed to the bishop for permission to take the roof off because this place had dwindled to a village with only about 60 people living in it, and they couldn't keep this huge, beautiful medieval church going anymore. And so they got permission to take the roof off. And within the ruined walls of that large church to this day is a humble chapel that is still in use as the village church. And that's one of the images that I've been walking with as to what the work of making good ruins, the work in the ruins, can look like. And this naming that, you know, world's end, it's part of what they do, that this is a thing that has happened before. It's not meant to be a lullaby. It's not meant to downplay the depth of the trouble around and ahead of us. And in At Work in the Ruins, a good part of that book is me reflecting on the years when my work revolved around being in rooms where we were talking about climate change, the part of the trouble around and ahead of us that rides under that name. But I think it matters that we are able to notice. I mean, Paul Kingsnorth and I in the Dark Mountain Manifesto put it this way. We said, the end of the world as we know it is not the end of the world, full stop. The ability to make that distinction, I mean, it's a distinction that is woven through lots of prophetic and theological language. So this feels like a setting in which it might land more easily than in some of the parts of the environmental movement that Paul and I were speaking to when we wrote those words. The world as we know it is not the thing to be saved at all costs. And there's been a danger all along, partly because of the depth of the trouble we're in, that we don't distinguish between the world as we know it and all that is worth living for. There was a day a few years ago, a year or two before the pandemic, when my phone started buzzing with messages, friends sending me a link to this article that was going viral. It was an article from The New Yorker. It was written by the novelist Jonathan Franzen. The reason people were sending it to me was because the title of the article was really similar to something I'd written. So Franzen's article, which some of you might remember, was called What If We Stop Pretending? He was saying, what if we stop pretending that, the climate crisis is a future problem that can be averted and avoided? What happens when we start to face up to it as something that's already here and that it's beyond our power to make it go away, to make everything okay, to bring everything under control and management? And, this was coming from from a very privileged author, journalist, writing in The New Yorker. It was going viral partly because of the fierceness of some of the responses to it, and understandably so. People were sending it to me because about 10 years earlier, I in the beginnings of Dark Mountain, I wrote a line that sounded rather similar. What do we do after we stop pretending? And that line had been picked up by Debbie Donowski and Eduardo Viveros de Castro and Bruno Latour, and it had sort of gone on a journey well beyond the context in which I wrote it. And my friend Charlotte Decan actually wrote to Jonathan Franzen and said, Jonathan, you really should have referenced Dougald. And he wrote back, he said, I have strong feels about attribution, but I've never heard of the guy, which is almost certainly true. And it doesn't matter, because anyway, if you're trying to do real culture work, then part of what it looks like is that things that you send out into the world travel onwards to the point where they've lost the labels attached to them that say that you might have been the person who wrote it down to begin with. None of that matters. What's interesting is that two words are different between the thing that I'd written and the thing that Jonathan Franzen wrote. And I think they might be the most important words in the original line. Those words are do and after. What do you do after you stop pretending? What do we do after? Versus what if we stop pretending? And I've sat with that over the years since, and it struck me that the absence of those two words reflects something that has a kind of dark irony to it, which is that often those of us who are most alive to the depth of the trouble which climate change represents are also those who, are the winners of the world as we know it. Highly educated, high cultural capital, urban people who find it hardest to imagine having anything useful that we could do after the end of the world within which our careers, our lives, our success has been made. And just recognizing that there might be a little glitch there, a little gap, a little excess of being unable to imagine anything going on that has to do with the helplessness that is revealed amongst the people who, according to the logic of progress, were meant to be the people who live closest to the future, the most developed, the people who are, highest up on the scale of the knowledge economy, and that a lot of the knowledge and skills that are going to be called for to navigate the difficult times ahead might be located elsewhere. There's a book that I found really helpful in unpicking that and starting to tell the story of what the humbling journey beyond the position that I'm using Jonathan Franzen to represent there looks like. A book called Ignition, Lighting Fires in a Burning World by M.R. O'Connor, Maura O'Connor, who's a journalist from New York who retrained as a wildland firefighter and controlled burn fire setter. And the book is her story of this. And when I met her, I said, this so easily could have been a book, which is journalist goes and does something and writes a book about it. It's not. It's human being goes and does something and is changed by it. You can't read that book without beyond the simple despair and helplessness which the climate crisis often brings us to, into a kind of humbling learning to show up on one of the front lines. And what you see in that book is her learning from and growing to love and respect people who have had very different lives to hers, many of whom didn't have the kind of education that she had, probably didn't vote for the same candidate at the last presidential election that she voted for. And finding how little that matters when you're on the front line together, learning from, depending on each other. And I feel like it's a book that actually models a good deal of what's called for in the years ahead. Going back a little further, and really I'm bringing you some stories today that are kind of in the mix of what I'm working with in this new book that I'm working on, but they were, when I looked at that picture of the hands with the seeds in them, that's the logo for Greenbelt this year, these were the stories that came to me. So one New Year's Eve, in the middle of the last decade, I was sat in the kitchen of a nice house in a desirable area in a European capital city. And there was a long way to go to midnight. And the conversation I was having with a friend of a friend had taken a wrong turning, because he was an advisor to a government minister, or he worked at a think tank, or he was an editor at a national newspaper. Doesn't really matter which of them. But in the world that he came from, progress was not a cultural logic or a story that we might need to lift up and look behind. It was a fact that could be demonstrated with figures, and I made no sense to him. I wasn't making a lot of sense to the logic of a world that, from where I was sitting, looked like it was ending. But because of the nature of the occasion, it was a small gathering. We had good friends in common. We had a lot of hours ahead of us. Rather than just looking for someone else to talk to, he stuck with me and we sat there. And you know, he made a really good faith effort to try and find some piece of common ground, something that I would agree with that would validate this kind of story of progress that animated everything that made sense to him. And what was fascinating was the baseline that he fell back to, because he said, all right, but at least you've got to agree that it's a good thing that we don't all have to work on the land anymore. And obviously, when it's put like that, it's got a touch of the, are you still beating your wife question to it. It's I could turn the question around. I could say, don't you think it's a troubling thing that so few of us know any of the people who are involved in growing our food or ever see the places where it comes from? But what I carried away from, or one of the things I carried away from that conversation, was a recognition of just how much our distance from the land has been foundational to the logic of progress. It's been the proof of how far we've come. And in the years after that conversation, more and more, I started to find myself dealing with people who were deep inside existing systems, high up inside existing institutions, and who, through the collision with what we know and what we have good grounds to fear about climate change, had arrived at a place where they were in a darker kind of pessimism than anything I had ever met in the conversations that Paul and I had brought together at Dark Mountain. Because these people, these insiders, I sometimes say it was as though they'd lost their faith in the promises of their institutions, but they hadn't questioned the theology of that faith. So they still thought of the world as something in need of saving by people like them in buildings like the ones they worked in. They just didn't think they were going to manage to do it. And part of why I wrote at Work in the Ruins was to try and build a bridge for the people I was meeting, the people I was becoming friends with from that kind of world, to help them out of this kind of loop between a kind of flat despair, a kind of black certainty of thinking you know how the story ends, and a desperate optimism that was starting to feed, you know, the crazy, scary projects of geoengineering and the rest of it. to say, you know, maybe the agency doesn't all lie where it was meant to, according to the maps that you were given. Maybe we're not as central to the story. Maybe we're not the ones holding all of the knowledge in the ways that those maps said. Maybe the future of how the world gets fed is going to have more to do with the 2 billion people in the world right now who are part of peasant farming households than with a startup in Finland growing bacteria in vats. Because the logic of progress teaches you to discount those 2 billion people and to put a very high valuation on that startup that's still raising venture capital funding. But what I saw among those people, people who were, you know, a lot like the guy I'd met that New Year's Eve, was that the same thing that had been a source of pride, the distance from the land, becomes a source of fear, a source of anxiety. Where is the food going to come from? And part of what I get from Federico Campagna's invitation to recognize the world's end, to look for the work that doesn't make sense, is that actually a lot of what's going to be called for is going to be getting back involved with land and food, getting back involved with all of the things that feed us. One of the things that I'm writing about in the new book is the paradox that the richest, longest lived societies the world has ever seen dedicate less care and attention and time to the work of culture than any of those who went before us. I've been collecting stories from all kinds of times and places that bear witness to how communities which on paper, according to the logic of development, we would have to categorize as very poor, have tended to devote an extraordinary amount of their time to things that we would think of as the work of culture, the arts. And at a certain point in time, I went back behind the language of culture as it comes down to us from the 19th century, when both that language of culture as the arts and the language of culture in anthropology took on their current forms, down into the etymological roots of those words. And what you find is that the etymology back into the Latin speaks to two things. It speaks to the tilling of the soil from which we get cultivation, and it speaks to the tending of the sacred, which is darkly echoed in our word cult. The growing of food and worship belong very close together in that language when you go down into its roots. And I started to wonder, thinking about this work around culture, and on the other hand, thinking about agriculture, our distance from the land and the work that feeds us. You know, we need to be fed in multiple ways. Part of the trouble we're in, and this is kind of the opening claim of the next book, is we're simultaneously materially some of the best fed people the world has ever known, and some of the culturally most malnourished people the world has ever known. And this paradox is really hard for us to bring into view and take seriously, because culture isn't meant to be a fundamental thing. It's meant to be a luxury, a soft surface layer, a thing that arrives with civilization. But actually, culture is all the way down in human history. And in a strange way, we are living with this simultaneous drowning in stuff and being starved of meaning. So what if we took the activities that feed us in all the senses, which include the ones we call culture and the ones we call agriculture, we took those activities and we tried to squeeze them into the corners. We tried to do them on a smaller and smaller part of the time and care and attention and the lives of the people within our societies. And we measured that in such a way that we could call it progress, economic growth. But that's part of the strangeness of the trouble we're in. And as I was thinking about this on the train this morning on my way into Stockholm, I was remembering something that my friend Graham Pardon, who's an American Orthodox Christian writer and poet, something that he says. He says, just imagine if we didn't take for granted the commodification of food and where it came from, if we had to approach the bread and wine with the kind of attention to, care about, involvement with the wheat and the grapes. And maybe we'd find our way to something that looked a little bit more like those Ethiopian churches that when you see them in the extraordinary aerial photographs, you get these circular tree gardens, these circular church forests around the churches. You know, maybe that's what that strange pairing of tilling the soil and tending the sacred in the roots of the language of culture is whispering to us about. The line that many of you will have heard, it's often attributed to Martin Luther, even if I knew that the world was going to fall apart tomorrow, I would still plant my apple tree. The earliest source for that is in Germany in 1944. So the chances are it's a line that somebody wrote down to try and share hope in a time of darkness and attached Luther's name to it. But a Muslim friend of mine told me that he'd had it told to him as a saying of the prophet. And when I started looking into it, I found that the earliest record of a line similar to this is a Jewish text that associates it with Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai in the generation that lived through the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And the version that's associated with him is, if you are standing with a sapling in your hand when they tell you the Messiah has come, first plant the sapling and then go out and greet the Messiah. And it's a line, when you read the commentaries on it, in that way that Jewish tradition is so much better at, there is such a multiplicity of different facets and different readings that are on offer for all that might be being said in that. But what strikes me is that here we have a persistent rumor that runs through our traditions down centuries, getting passed around and showing up in dark times, that talks about planting trees at the end of the world. And maybe it's a rumor that persists because it points to a truth that is deeper and older than the cities of men. The truth that seeds fall into the ground and life is born again. The truth that worlds end and trees outlast them. And that humans can be involved in the possibility of trees outlasting worlds. Because my friend Thomas Keyes is a wonderful artist from Northern Ireland. He lives now way up in the north of Scotland. He works with the graffiti techniques that he grew up learning as a kid on the streets of Belfast, bringing them together with the illuminated manuscript traditions from 13 centuries earlier from the coasts of Scotland and Ireland. And he wrote a wonderful piece for one of the early Dark Mountain books, a recipe for October Black Isle pheasant stew, about making stew from a roadkill pheasant with things he'd foraged in the woods for his kids' tea. And there's a bit in that where he says, you know, most of the year when I'm out in the woods, I feel clumsy compared to all the other creatures around me. But there's one moment in the cycle of the seasons where I feel like I fit. And it's when the hazelnuts are ripe, but they haven't yet fallen from the trees, because that's what fingers are for. At the end of the last ice age, the landscape in Europe was reseeded from tiny pockets, tiny microclimates that happened to have been hospitable to species which had otherwise been absent from the tundra during the cold 1200 years of the Younger Dryas, the last period of the Ice Age. And within a very short period of time, the climate warmed by between 5 and 7 degrees, probably within somewhere between 10 and 30 years in Europe. And out of those pockets, almost certainly with the help of human fingers. The nuts and the seeds began to spread back out across the landscape. It's an image that I find hopeful for how things that look too small to matter, too small to make a difference. You know, they call them cryptic northern refugia, those pockets where those species survived. They're cryptic because they're almost too small to show up in the record. But they're the places, the seed banks from which a world was reseeded after the ice. So those are a few of the stories that I find myself carrying on this particular Saturday morning as I sit here. It looks like a photo booth, doesn't it, with the curtain behind me in this little windowless room in Stockholm, talking to those of you in the field and to those of you watching this online. Thanks for joining me and listening to those stories.
Thank you so much, Dugald. There's such depth and density there. And in a moment, I'm going to open up for questions from the floor. I first heard Dugald tell that story of the acorns being found in the pockets deep in the middle of winter in a basement in London. I'd gone to hear him speak, and I couldn't help but think, I guess because I'm biased and because it's my job, that I would love Greenbelt to be such a pocket, which is nurturing the seeds that will be sown into the next thing after this thing has finally died. And it gave me a huge amount of hope and encouragement. Still pretty scary. Anyway, I'd like to throw it open. Who's got questions? We've got microphones that can come round and take your questions. And Dugald has given us, you know, half of his time this morning for questions. I can see a hand at the back, at the risk of sounding like a preacher. And yes.
Hi. So I just want to say I've really appreciated your and Paul Kingsnorth's work over the years. As someone who's involved in the climate movement, has been for years. However, I guess my concern is, like, how does it not just become a retreat from working for justice? Like, and you did touch on it, but especially for people who, like, you know, are going to be horrifically affected by climate change. Like, yeah, I guess I worry that it can just be a bit of a talking shop, but I really appreciate your work.
Thank you. Well, it's tricky being a storyteller in a time when there are so many other kinds of work that are needed. And I hope that the reframe that I'm offering helps to put some power behind people who are working on agendas that are more realistic and less enchanted by the promises of the world that is ending. That it helps to center the knowledge of those who aren't sitting in offices in Brussels, oscillating between imagining themselves to be the people who have to save the world and imagining that because they can't believe in that, the world is going to be over really soon. And I've sat across the table from people who are in that place. Moving them away from the center of the story, putting the people who are actually carrying the knowledge and actually doing the work of growing food, I hope that that puts some power behind those who need it and who need to be at the center of the story. You know, I was sat on a call yesterday with the board members of an organization that I just joined, where, you know, that organization has come into being to try and channel what, if they succeed, will be very large amounts of money into grassroots projects in bioregions around the world that are working within this paradigm that says it's not about trying to make the ways of living of the Western middle classes sustainable, which is basically what sustainability has always ended up boiling down to. that it's actually about a humbling for those of us who, you know, maybe don't know where to start when it comes with working with land and food, and a centering and, you know, a getting behind the struggles of those who are still deeply hands-on involved with that, near and far. So, you know, to me, that's where the work that I'm doing and the things that I'm trying to speak for connect up. I remember being on a call a couple of years ago with a group of journalists from across the Arab world, where they were working with an organization in the Netherlands. And it was a very large organization of investigative journalists from across the Arab world. And they had, you know, this summer school was being arranged by this institution in the Netherlands. And the journalists organization had said, we want to spend this week looking at the stories we tell about climate change, because we know that we know it's not working. And in that session, one of the journalists, a young woman from Jordan, spoke up, and she spoke almost apologetically. She said, you know, I'm really sorry, we can't do the kind of activism that you're able to do in these free countries in Europe. We don't have anything that's equivalent to Extinction Rebellion, which I would have been talking about. She said, you know, the closest thing I can think of is this thing called the People's Bread Movement. And she told us this extraordinary story that over the year or two before that in Jordan, this movement had started of growing wheat in the spaces between apartment buildings in the cities, and this network growing and harvesting wheat. And in all of the bakeries around the country, you could buy loaves of this thing that was called People's Bread, which were made from the wheat that was being grown in this movement. And she was telling us this apologetically, going, you know, we can't do the thing that you're doing of, you know, organizing and having protests and demonstrations. The best we can do is this. And I said, you know, this story needs to be passed on. And so I did where I got speaking to activist networks in the UK and elsewhere in the months after it, I was passing on that story, because, you know, that's not a poor apology for what our movements need to be doing. It's a step beyond. And as I told it, people also started telling me powerful stories from parts of England about groups that had started through kind of national XR mobilizations and were going back into their communities and getting involved with food insecurity work in, you know, parts of the northeast of England near where I grew up. And, you know, we need stories to help keep these things moving. And some of those stories do involve that difficult moment of saying, I no longer believe in the stuff that we've been promising, the stuff we've been saying is going to save it and fix it. But it's that do after, and recognizing that, you know, the people who've got most to bring to the doing after, to the making imaginable and possible of the doing after, are often not the people who, like me, who have been given the most platform and had the loudest voices. I hope that helps to speak to what you're feeling and recognizing that.
I don't know if you can see Dougald, but I think there's a gentle nod of appreciation for your answer. Thank you. Do we have another question? There's someone down the front here has got a hand up. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. That was great. Thank you so much for sharing. So I'm involved in working with churches that have a pretty screwed up story about the future, and trying to re-energize a story about restoration and trying to draw down that future. And I really appreciate the distinction about the end of the world not being the end of the world, right? Could you say a bit more about how the future looks to you? That kind of, you know, could you paint a picture of what lies beyond?
There are two things that are coming to mind for me. The first is something that I heard many times from Vanessa Andreotti, who some of you probably know as Vanessa Machado de Oliveira, because that's the name under which she wrote Hospicing Modernity. And for years, she would say to me, you know, she'd use this phrase, presently unimaginable futures. The things worth working for now, the futures worth working for, are presently unimaginable. And it took a long time before that sort of that seed cracked open for me. And when it did, what I recognized was, okay. Like often we get a bunch of us who are pretty privileged brought together into a room to do some kind of imaginative exercises to project a future worth working towards and then back forecast from that to how we're going to realize it. What she was saying is really, we can't imagine the futures worth working for. We have to be changed in order to become people who could be part of those futures. We have to lose a lot of who we thought we were, where we thought we were going, what we thought our role was and our relation to others. And Hospicing Modernity as a book, and the sequel to it, Outgrowing Modernity, is just coming out, have a lot of practical like exercises for what you can do together that can actually, you know, lead into that kind of vulnerability of being changed, rather than the kind of effortful projection of will that's often implicit in imagining the good future. So that's one way of answering it. Another way, you know, more practically, if you're working in a UK context, I really would recommend Chris Smage's books, starting with A Small Farm Future. And then he has one which is coming out this autumn, which I got to read an advanced copy of, called Finding Light in a Dark Age. And he also hosts a really good ongoing conversation on his Small Farm Future blog. And Chris is both a farmer and a social scientist by training and by his earlier career, who can put a lot of flesh on the kinds of future that might be available to us if the read on the signs of the times that I'm working with is anywhere close to true. And it's not, what you get from Chris is never a sales pitch. There's a kind of a willingness to acknowledge the difficulty of it. But nonetheless, you know, if you want a very different story about what might be worth doing and what the future could look like, then Chris's work, I think, could be a helpful starting point for some people. It is for me.
Thank you. I see some hands just back towards the mixing desk here.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. I guess my question is, how can we avoid building hope in the ruins turning into just another form of progress-seeking behavior? And I'm thinking specifically even about activism as a concept, because when I think about trees, they don't try and change the world, they just sit there. And I think about the obscurity of trees and how unknown they are, how they have no sense in which they need to reach beyond them to make the change themselves. So yeah, how do we stop this from being just another progress movement?
Thank you. Great question. The phrase that I found myself landing on in this new book is getting back involved with the world. Like, the call is not to save the world as if we're superheroes standing above it. The call is to get back involved with the world. You know, as the seasons become less predictable, which anyone who's involved in, even in the smallest way, with gardening knows is where we're at, that's going to call for more time and attention and care and ingenuity in our involvement with it. And getting back involved with the world is very different to trying to manage and fix the world. And activism can show up in either of those forms. I don't identify as an activist, not because I want to keep my hands clean, but because there are people who I admire who deserve that name. And I don't feel like the work that I do, I hope, is of use to them. But I don't want to pretend that I'm putting myself on the line in the same way that those friends are doing. One of the things I suppose might be worth sharing from near the end of At Work in the Ruins, I had a little list, an unfinished list, of the kinds of work that might make sense in a time of endings. And maybe this has some clues that speak to what you're asking. And I said there are four kinds of work that I've noticed I'm sure there are more. There are things I've left out here. But first one is getting involved with salvaging good things that we have a chance of taking with us, taking responsibility for something that has a chance of coming through and where what we're doing might make a difference to that. The second is mourning the good things that we lose. And, you know, like all mourning, that involves telling the stories and singing the songs. Because, you know, there are going to be achievements of recent history that probably aren't going to come through the bottleneck ahead of us, through the hard times ahead of us. But if we can carry the stories of those things, then maybe those stories will turn out to be seeds in worlds that we can't imagine yet. The third kind of work is a work of discernment, noticing the things that were never as good as we told each other they were, about the ways we've been doing things around here lately. And maybe even the chance to walk away from some of those things that's part of a time of endings. And the fourth kind of work is a work of picking up the dropped threads from earlier in the story, noticing the things that have been marked as old-fashioned, inefficient, outgrown, that, you know, it's never about simply going back, but it might be about picking up and weaving back in some of those things and them turning out to make all the difference on the journey ahead. And part of the point of a sort of back of an envelope list like that is just that it can help us to recognize that none of us is going to be engaged in all of those kinds of work. You know, and it doesn't even mention the work of resistance, which is also there. And that's also in the text in the book where I write about this. But it's to recognize that we might be working on very different things. And they might all be part of the patchwork of what's called for, in the same way as the different creatures and species within a forest are part of the patchwork of the forest. We don't need a plantation. You can't plan or design or build a tree. You know, at most that gets you a plantation, which is not the same thing as a living forest. But you can contribute to the conditions of viability of a living forest. You know, 50, 70, 100 years ago, white scientists were going out to the Amazon and describing it as if the reason for this flourishing abundance was that it was so sparsely populated of humans. Now we know that the reason for its abundance is a centuries and centuries and centuries long involvement of humans in the co-creation of this extraordinary food forest, this extraordinary living work of many species culture. And, you know, which is absolutely under threat, and people are fighting to defend as much as possible of it right now. And we need to bring all of those stories into the mix because they have clues. And, you know, part of the humbling is kind of coming down off the entitlement that might have animated some of the ways we thought we could get involved in changing the world, and into a sense of ourselves as something smaller. There's one more bit on that. It sometimes strikes me that there's been a model of agency, especially close to the centers of power during modernity, which is modeled on a particular idea of what it might be to be a monotheistic God. It's not even theologically a very good idea of what it might be like to be God, but it's basically step one, omniscience. Step two, omnipotence. So first, we have to know the world from above and create the objective data sets and all of the rest of it. And then we have to act on it from above. And, you know, part of the despair that I'm describing in these kind of institutional contexts that I started to find myself in around 2018, 2019, is really the product of people who have been inhabiting that model of agency, when they admit to themselves it's failure, but haven't yet let in the possibility that there might be humbler modes of agency, ways we can show up, things we can do that might be small enough to make a difference rather than the old sense of having to scale up and be big enough to make a difference.
Thank you. I think there's someone been waiting a long time over there. Sorry, I was hiding underneath that wing at the stage.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your talk. I came here and felt really, really low I come to Greenbelt feeling really low. What can I do? Hopeless. And very practical person. And I'm just thinking about this, what you were saying about the link between food and us. And with young grandchildren now, I've come up with the idea, I'm sure somebody's done it before, but beavers and allotments and trying to, you know, it's non-threatening to everyone. You talk about climate change and you get deniers and pro people. And I just think that might be something I could practically do to help me, help myself as well as them. And if there's anybody in the audience who has got any information or suggestions, I'd really appreciate it. And thank you again.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. It makes me think of one of the regular commenters on Chris Smage's Small Farm Future blog, which has one of the kind of friendliest and most diverse commentariats of any of the sites I know on the internet. But one of the regulars is a woman, I think her name is Catherine, in London, who is both a musician and a local grower. I think she has two allotments and she's involved in growing a sort of food garden in the grounds of her local church that she's very involved in. And I get so inspired by her, you know, in-depth, often very practical comments on there, sharing experiences from the allotments and the food garden and the soup kitchen and the kind of journey of working with a very ordinary local church where not everybody gets why this might be part of the work that you're being called to. So, there's people come alive when they get involved with things like this. My, you know, one of the most daring and courageous examples that I am constantly learning from is my friend Adam Wilson at Sand River Community Farm in upstate New York, who writes a Substack called The Peasantry School. And he's a farmer. He's been a farmer for over 20 years. And for the last 5 years, he's been living entirely in the gift economy. So he's living under a vow, effectively, that none of the food from the land he farms will be sold for money or otherwise exchanged. It's all given to anyone who is hungry for any reason. And as he says, that includes most of us a couple of times a day. And he tells a story of a young father who came to one of the gratitude feasts that they have at the farm and comes up to Adam at the end and says, you know, I didn't think that something like this could actually exist anymore. And Adam says, well, what is it you're noticing? And he says, well, it's like you've all created an irony-free zone. And I read that and I thought, how many, especially young people, you know, it's even more intense when you think of it as a young person who's themselves raising young children, lack any experience of pockets of conviviality and hospitality and generosity of the kind that that young man was experiencing there. And I think in one way or another, you know, we can do these things because we need them ourselves. That's a very, very good reason to be doing something. It has a lot of power in it. And they can also become those pockets that other people badly need as well. And I think of it as kind of practicing, like building up the wasted muscles. For a number of generations, we've lived in societies where the logic of the market and the logic of the state carried so much of the work and occupied so much of the space of our ways of being human together that many of us lost the knack of what humans are capable of when we come together for reasons other than because we've been paid to or because we've been told to. And I mean, from back when I was living in London and doing things like the West Norwood Feast, the community-owned and run street market that we created when I was running Spacemakers Agency with local people in West Norwood. You know, so much of that for me has always been about how we start the workouts of rebuilding the muscles of coming together and doing things for reasons more meaningful than the reasons that the state and the market give us. And, you know, again, on their better days, churches are one of the pockets, one of the cryptic northern refugia within which some knowledge and practice of what humans are capable of when we come together for reasons that don't make sense to the logic of the market or the state can be what we're capable of, the ways we can come alive together. So, yeah, good luck. I wish you well with the allotment and don't undervalue it. And, oh, check out, if you can, Pam Warhurst, Incredible Edible Ptarmigan. Find a talk by her online about the food growing project that she and her friends created in Todmorden, because I find it impossible not to be inspired and uplifted whenever I watch a talk from Pam Warhurst.
Thank you so much, Dougald. I just knew when our theme was hope in the making that we simply had to have Dougald speak at the festival. I hope that something in you feels the same way. After I read Dougald's book, At Work in the Ruins, I lent it to a really good friend of mine who works in future cities globally, you know, looking at all the technology that's going to sort out our cities. And he read it, and I had a meal with him next. I said, so what did you think? He said, well, it's really good, but he's just a bit of a hippie, isn't he? And I thought that, in a way, that cuts straight to the essence of what Dougald's trying to suggest that we admit to ourselves about where we are and the ways that we might find forward. I would also like to say that Dougald's book is available in the bookshop here at Greenbelt, and I would urge you to buy a copy, probably buy two and give one to a friend. I'd also like to thank Dougald very much for his time. He's in much demand, belonging to so many forums across his life. And I'm thank you for spending an hour with us at Greenbelt. Can you give Dougald a big thank you?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts. For free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.